Welcome to Advanced Nuclear, the official podcast of UCAN Power, where leading experts, innovators, and policymakers explore the latest developments shaping the future of nuclear energy.
Welcome to the Advanced Nuclear Podcast. I'm your host, Jim Howe, for UCAN Power. We advocate for bringing cutting-edge nuclear technologies to market to bolster our energy and national security. And in this podcast, we talk to the movers and shakers in the advanced nuclear industry. When you count the number of companies seeking to bring advanced nuclear technologies to market, it's easy to get overwhelmed. In the United States alone, there are literally dozens of reactor developers that are working on their technologies and deployment plans, some large, many small, with a variety of different reactor designs. It's an exciting and dynamic time for the industry. Many of the companies are pursuing what we call Generation 4 reactors, which typically don't use water as a coolant and have many attractive use cases and inherent safety features. And one family of Generation 4 reactors uses molten salt as the coolant, and in some cases for both coolant and the fuel itself. Today we're speaking with one of America's best and most established molten salt reactor companies, Terrestrial Energy, which is in the midst of a very exciting year. You can learn about them at terrestrialenergy.com. Our guest today has a unique and distinguished background. Simon Irish is the CEO of Terrestrial Energy and comes from the world of finance. He has 20 years of global investment banking and investment management experience in New York and London. He's earned master's degrees in natural sciences and finance from Cambridge University and the London Business School, respectively. Simon has established and managed multi-billion dollar alternative investment businesses and is the former head of Man Global Strategies in North America, the strategic investment division of Man Group PLC, a leading global investment management business. So when it comes to money and financing and how it relates to the advanced nuclear industry, Simon is the man to talk to. Simon, thank you for joining us on the Advanced Nuclear Podcast. We're grateful you could share your expertise with us, and we're excited to hear about the latest on Terrestrial Energy.
Thanks, Jim, and good talking to you this morning, and thanks for having me.
Super. Well, you know, on this podcast, we've talked to, you know, many CEOs and senior leaders of other advanced reactor companies, and most of them come from nuclear and engineering and project management backgrounds. You have a different lineage with, you know, your decades of experience in the financial and banking communities. How did you get involved with nuclear energy, and what led you to become the CEO of Terrestrial Energy?
Well, that's an interesting question. Yes, Jim, I think it's quite true that coming from Wall Street when I did, I've got a little bit of unusual background in the nuclear industry, but yes, I spent 10 years in investment banking in London at a time when the banks wanted graduates with sort of quantitative degrees to crack complex, exotic trading models and derivative models. And I worked for a company called Credit Suisse Financial Products, and then moved to New York, and was in a quite prominent position in the investment management world for 10 years. In about 2009, took a sabbatical to contemplate, because of sort of momentous changes that were just occurred, to contemplate the world, particularly the next big thing. And it was meant to be a short sabbatical, but I was quite, if you want to think about big things, the energy sector is super big. And I was also intrigued by the energy sector given change afoot in it, namely energy security and decarbonization were big, major themes influencing our energy choices going forward. But I gravitated very, very quickly to nuclear because nuclear is unique. It's immensely scalable in a way which nothing else can possibly compete. And my sabbatical started drifting on, shall we say, and through a rather interesting set of happenstances ended up becoming, about 3 years later, ended up becoming the founding executive of Terrestrial Energy. Now, I was looking at the energy sector through an interesting prism. I was looking at it saying, nuclear energy is this wonderful thing. Okay, nuclear energy must play this major role going forward. But the challenge we have is a commercial one, that our nuclear machine is not up to the commercial task. And I was looking at the nuclear machine through the prism of someone who's been, spent, half his career at that point in time, 20 years, looking through, every commercial problem through the prism of capital. And the nuclear machine is not attracting capital. Why not? It's not efficient enough to attract capital. So what is wrong with the nuclear machine? And I started sort of looking behind the curtain at that rich tapestry of many different technologies at a national lab level, all these Generation 4 technologies, and asking a really fundamental question. Are any of these technologies that have been sitting behind that screen for 50 years up to the task today? They, you know, if you look to the nuclear industry and how technologies have been selected, they've been selected for many different reasons. But I don't think nuclear technologies have ever been selected solely from the perspective of commercial performance of a nuclear machine in a competitive market. And I set about over this three-year period before I founded Terrestrial Energy, looking for a machine that I thought was much more capable of delivering and attracting, attracting capital, but also capable of doing it quickly. You don't want to spend 30 years, developing a better machine. That's the wrong time frame. That sits out of the planning time frame and the investment time frame for those with capital and those who wish to use your machine. So you had to do it quickly. So I with that criteria in mind, I had the opportunity of meeting David LeBlanc, who's my partner in the business. He's the chief technology officer. And David met my criteria. David's design of molten salt reactor met my criteria as a nuclear machine that could be developed quickly and was very much aligned with the commercial requirements that I believe had to be met if you were to have a successful new nuclear machine.
Interesting. So tell us a little bit about Terrestrial Energy. When was it formed? It sounds like over a decade ago, right? And where are you located? Yeah. How big is the workforce?
Yeah, it was a pretty high compelling high conviction view, Jim. I mean, we founded Terrestrial Energy in the immediate aftermath of Fukushima. So you have to have a very high conviction view of the direction of travel in the world. Terrestrial Energy was seeking to develop the classic molten salt reactor, the one that's demonstrated at Oak Ridge National Lab, quite famously in the late 60s, the MSRE. We established, we sought strategically to, from the get-go, to answer a really important question. You've got Generation 4 technology that have been used in commercial markets. You've got a highly regulated industry. A really important question that you have to, milestone that you have to prioritize in your development plan is the regulatory milestone. Is this technology capable of being licensed for commercial use? So we tactically engaged with the Canadian regulator, the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission, engaged in their process called the vendor design review process. And that process, which is now complete, gave us the big green light that we needed commercially, because they've reviewed every aspect of this design and concluded there are no fundamental barriers to using it commercially. And that is so important for us and all those involved in this project, both on the commercial side, the supply chain side, to move forward with the project. Having had that scrutiny, that detailed scrutiny, by a world-class regulator, there are probably three that matter in the world commercially. Obviously, the NRC in Washington, the Canadian regulator in Ottawa, and the Office of Nuclear Regulation in London. So, our system at this point in time, 10 years, 12 years after we started to, developing and designing it, has received a very detailed level of scrutiny by a world-class regulator.
And you're now out of Charlotte, North Carolina, correct? Is it headquarters?
Yes. So when we set up the business, it wasn't clear, in the aftermath of Fukushima, who really wanted to, from a policy perspective, promote nuclear really aggressively. But I have to say, by the time you got to 2018, 2019, 2020, it's very, very clear. It's becoming very, very clear that the United States was not going to give up its historic lead in civilian reactor technology. Congress started taking action. And at this point in time, it's sort of abundantly clear to us, along with many others in our sector, that the United States is the place to be and the place to focus on. And we've been focused on the United States now for probably 3 or 4 years.
Great. Well, Charlotte,
our office in Charlotte, North Carolina. Yes.
Yeah, you can't find a nicer place to be home ported. That's for sure. So,
North Carolina, Charlotte's a great place to. To have a business and to build a business.
Well, so the big buzz this year is Terrestrial Energy is going public, you know, through a combination with HCM2 Acquisition Corp. What's the latest on the transaction? Whatever you can tell us. I know it's a sensitive time, but and how are things going?
Yeah, so we announced a merger on the 26th of March with Hyundai's Capital Management. Chief executive is a gentleman called Sean Matthews. Sean is the former chief executive of Cantor Fitzgerald. So in my view, it's a very appropriate counterparty as you look to navigate the complexity of this type of transaction. Going public is never straightforward. So you want to be doing it with a business partner who's got the sort of acumen to make it a success. But it sits within a strategic goal of the company. And that is, when you looked at how demand for nuclear is evolving now, it's extremely impressive. Now, from a business strategy perspective, you have to decide, the speed at which you want to develop your business. And at this point in time, we want to develop our business very aggressively. Now is the time to grow and grow aggressively. And this transaction that we're pursuing for a public listing is part of that strategy to grow aggressively.
Understood. So with your expertise and with your background, our listeners would love to hear your views on the availability of private sector capital for the advanced nuclear projects, both yours and others. From the outside, it seems that we've turned a corner in regard to increased investment. How would you characterize the current environment?
Yes, well, the availability of capital has changed tremendously, and probably even as recently of the last 2 years. If you looked at capital in public markets, the public sector investors are becoming increasingly interested in gaining exposure to the type of massive innovation factors that are now at play in the nuclear tech sector, particularly intersection between nuclear tech and AI. They want to get factor exposure to those type of innovations, and they realize that those type of factors could have a tremendous change economically, and they want to get investment exposure to it. So in public markets, you have an appetite now, which I think is secular. This is a point of time in innovation, which in any sector where public market investors are saying there's something extraordinary, interesting going on here. It's not cyclical. This is a one-off moment. I want to participate. I want to get exposure. So the access to capital now, because of that tremendous change in sentiment, is really very different compared to 3 years ago.
And that's all good news, right, for our industry? So
no, that's very good news. I mean, for nuclear to flourish and blossom, going back to my background, is nothing happens in the world until you match capital with it. Otherwise, it's just a good idea.
Yep, got it. That's probably as well stated as I've ever heard it. So thank you. So let's talk a little bit more about the company. One thing that really stands out when you look at Terrestrial Energy is how impressive your board of directors, your board of advisors are. You've got just some real luminaries there. Tell us about them. I mean, it's just a great team you've put together.
Yeah, I mean, it's for me personally, it's been a sort of total privilege actually to be building the company, which way as you go along and build the company, you attract people who are extraordinarily accomplished in their own in their own walk of life, and we have attracted as a company directors to the company to support it from a governance perspective and a strategy perspective, who are tremendously accomplished. And we have C-suite chief executives, COOs from some of the leading nuclear companies in the United States, Pacific Gas and Electric, TVA, Constellation, former COO of Constellation, former chief executive of Shaw Group. It's a very, very impressive group of people that are on the board of directors of the company. Our advisory board we formed an advisory board as well, recognizing that nuclear sits in this probably more than any other sector. Maybe defense is similar, but nuclear sits on the intersection between commerce and government policy, and that's quite a complicated intersection. Particularly, if you look at it historically, the nuclear industry has always been entwined around certain policy and national security issues. So to help us navigate that, we formed an advisory board to help us navigate that policy factor and also the regulatory factor too. But we've got some extraordinarily accomplished people on our advisory board, G7 cabinet ministers, and we have a former NRC commissioner. And that reach extends also to other markets that we are attentive to at the moment, obviously Canada and the UK, but our principal focus on the United States.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about the technology itself. It's a molten salt reactor. You call it the integral molten salt reactor. What are its basic operating characteristics in terms of electrical and thermal output and the like?
Yeah, so I mean, the reason we're using a molten salt reactor is not as interesting. It's because we think it's it solves the problem that is worth solving, and the problem that's worth solving is cost and affordability of the current nuclear machine. It's too expensive. That's the problem that's worth solving. So so as the innovator in the space, fundamental statement. What's your problem statement? The problem that's worth solving with private capital is the cost and affordability problem of conventional nuclear. We're solving on the molten salt reactor. And the reason we're doing that, it has three operating characteristics that give you a very, very compelling argument as to why you think you'll solve that problem. And those three operating characteristics are high temperature, low pressure, and high inherent safety. So Jim, if you got high temperature supply from the nuclear system, you have a super efficient steam turbine. This is not industrial marketing. This is based on thermodynamics. Our nuclear systems drive a steam turbine at 50% more efficiently than the steam turbine from a conventional nuclear plant. I mean, that is a tremendous improvement in commercial, in capital efficiency. That goes to the heart of the problem you're trying to solve, which is the affordability of cost. Your steam turbine is 50% more efficient. That's a very good start, I'd say, excellent start. So it operates at high temperature, operates at low pressure, and this is the virtue of a molten salt. A molten salt is an excellent heat transport fluid. All machines require the transport of heat, even the car, your gasoline engine on the way to work. If you use a molten salt, it's a very thermally stable, a super stable coolant in a nuclear reactor, so you can operate it at a high temperature. But because it's thermally very stable, you can operate it at low pressure as well. You've got a low pressure cooling system. And that's a tremendous engineering advantage because your cooling system is the center of your safety case. It can never fail. And the failure mode of a high pressure cooling system is you lose pressure. Okay, so that's not a failure mode of our system. So it eases the engineering environment tremendously when you're operating a cooling system at low pressure. And the third one is high inherent safety, and that's inherent safety is safety associated with the system itself. So with a molten salt, fuel, and coolant, you have certain properties you will not see in solid fuel reactors, one of which is fluid convection. Fluid convection is a very important mechanism of heat dissipation, and that's part of the safety case of a reactor, how you dissipate heat, particularly in accident conditions. So with a molten salt, you have heat dissipation through fluid convection, and there are other features as well. There's functional containment, where the fission products created from in the molten salt fuel get actually contained through ionic bonding into the salt, and you don't get these features in conventional reactor systems. So those three features, temperature, pressure, inherent safety, are critically important to your economic argument, your primary argument to say this is going to be a much more affordable machine. It has two commercial consequences. I mentioned the steam turbine. You can drive your steam turbine much more efficiently with high temperature steam supply. And secondly, you have for the first time the ability to service the industrial sector that's looking for a clean energy alternative to fossil fuel combustion. You have high temperature heat that you can now use directly in industry, in the chemical sector, the petrochemical sector, the mining sector for ore beneficiation. So you have many other opportunities for nuclear power, not just sort of grid electric power generation, which has been its conventional mode of deployment historically.
And you're deploying in pairs, is that correct? And what's the kind of total output of those? Yes.
So our standard power plant design consists of two operating reactors. So that plant, those two together give you about 800, just over 800 megawatt thermal. And if you decide to use all that heat for electric power generation, it's just under 400 megawatt electrical. at the plant level, and that's net. So it's net at plant load, just under 400 megawatt electric.
Yeah, that's a lot of power. But you also have another characteristic that we haven't really talked about. The fuel itself, it's you're using something different than a lot of the other advanced reactor companies.
It just goes back to the problem statement. You know, the problem statement is affordability and cost, but do it quickly. If you do it quickly, from the get-go, you have to look behind and say, well, if I want to do it quickly, let's look at my supply chain before I start making important design decisions. So, you know, this is going back 10 years now. We're looking at our supply chain going, well, if you want fuel, not for the first reactor, this is about race to fleet deployment, not the first reactor. So you're looking at your supply chain and say, I need my supply chain to scale quickly with me. I probably want to use standard nuclear fuel if I'm going to do that. I don't want to use what's called high assay LEU. I want to use what we refer to be explicit about this, standard assay LEU. Standard assay LEU is low enriched uranium, enriched to no more than 5%. That's been the world standard in civilian power plants for over half a century. So we 10 years ago, made the decision to use that that nuclear fuel. And we stand apart from many other in the sector. So in that important intersection of, you know, you want a reactor that generates high quality heat for that steam turbine for those many purposes. So you want a generation four system such as a molten salt reactor to do that. You also want fuel for fleet scale. On the intersection of those two factors, there's one company that sits today, and that's Terrestrial Energy. So that was a really important call that we made 10 years ago, and I think it puts us in a very competitive position as people are looking at technologies that are capable of rapidly scaling to meet the demand for nuclear energy going forward.
Yeah, and it sounds like that was a very wise strategic choice. I know that coming from the fuel industry myself, we were pushing really hard to work on HALEU and get that part of the segment of the industry stood up. But it's been slower than we had hoped, and a lot of the companies are now having to kind of, you know, work really hard to, you know, secure their supply chains. But it sounds like you've got it that kind of behind you already.
You know, if you've got the opportunity in your business plan to avoid, you know, problems like that, you grab it with two hands. And we did it early, about 10 years ago. So we don't want that problem. We're going to use standard nuclear fuel.
Got it. Excellent. So you had touched on this, use cases for the IMSR. You know, what industries are you targeting?
Yeah. Well, I think the use case for IMSR is there's a fourth point I've mentioned here, actually, about sort of operating characteristics, and that's high energy density. So high energy density, Jim, means that you have something that's capable of being small and modular. Not all generation four systems are high energy dense energy systems. Light water reactors, by the way, are high energy dense. They're good for modularity. Molten salt reactors are capable of being a high energy dense nuclear system. So very good for a small and modular nuclear plant. And this is really exciting in terms of the deployment mode that's needed today. With a small and modular nuclear plant, you have the opportunity to bring almost gigawatt scale industrial production close to the point of industrial demand, whether it's a data center, chemical plant, petrochemical plant, whatever it is. So the opportunity for us today is to be that small and modular nuclear plant and deploy in that co-located manner. And I think that's super important when you look at energy infrastructure today. You get bottlenecks in it. We have grid congestion. The idea that you put something massive at the center of the grid and then string cables and distribute it, that's going to take a lot of time to build that out. But if you can bring, I don't think this deployment mode for energy supply has been seen ever. If you can actually bring the means of gigawatt scale industrial production with a small and modular nuclear plant to point of industrial demand, you have something that is really unique in a different paradigm. Now, we have the ability to do that, but when we bring our plant to that point of industrial demand, the use case is much more expansive because the primary operating characteristic is high temperature energy supply. So at that point of industrial demand, we can service heat, power, and any combination in between. And in terms of that combination, the back end of our plant, Jim, does not consist of nuclear systems. This is one of the virtues of some generation four systems. It's not a virtue of light water reactors, by the way. Our steam systems are non-nuclear. Okay, so what you can do is you can basically rearrange them quickly without having to, you know, re-argue your safety case, which is uneconomic. You can't do that. So you can bring your plant to the point of industrial demand, and you can customize the back end of it. Customize your steam systems, customize your power systems to meet the requirements of that particular customer, whether it's a data center, chemical plant, petrochemical plant. This is a totally new deployment paradigm for nuclear. Not only is it small and modular, but it's customized to the customer. It's customizable to the the energy user that has his own set of requirements, his heat requirements, his power requirements, his reliability requirements as well. So there are other systems you may wish to add to make sure that you achieve the reliability requirements. But you're doing all that outside that nuclear regulatory envelope, and you need to do it outside the nuclear regulatory envelope, because if you have to argue a safety case, Jim, as I mentioned, it's not going to work commercially.
Understood. And you've talked a lot about how you've made choices to keep things as simple as possible and as economic as possible. What do you think in a practical sense, what's your build time? Is this a decade? Is it something shorter for your first of a kind, nth of a kind?
Jim, I'm going to give you the generic model, and the generic model is how it was. We're looking at a world going forward where build time, which includes the regulatory piece, could change tremendously. So I don't want to speculate on that. But if you looked at how it was, this is sort of a generic paradigm. It's 5 plus 5 years. 5 years, 5 plus 5 years, a 10-year project to actually get the thing, get the nuclear power plant commissioned. First 5 years is dealing with site preparation and site characterization work, construction permits. And then you stick a shovel in the ground in the beginning of your sixth year. And it's 6 years, and it's 5 years to actually construct it. So that's the model that we're operating to, but we recognize that could shrink. Certainly as you move into nth plant, the construction time, this is small and modular, the construction time could shrink from 5 years to four, maybe three, if you start getting your supply chain involved in a big way, making those modules in a factory setting for site assembly, you get it down to 3 years. The regulatory piece, I think, particularly on the construction permit piece, I think there's some good opportunity to reduce that as well. So the whole sort of package now is being shrunk, but we'll start off at the one end of the bookcase with how it was, the 5 plus 5 year paradigm. But there's a lot of opportunities to move, to move to the other end of the bookcase, and have a really quite compelling construction time for a nuclear power plant.
And we've seen from a lot of the companies out there different use cases in different business models as to who will build and own and operate the reactors. How does Terrestrial Energy generate its revenues? What's your business model?
In many respects, actually, our business model is not that original. So we're designing a nuclear power plant, but we're not looking to build it. There are others that are expert at building it. And project management is such a key part of the economics. You want someone who's expert on project management to deliver to schedule and by extension cost as well. Delays are expensive. Capital compounds during delays. So there's the EPC community in the United States, I think there's plenty of people there who've got, will always have far better capabilities than we will have when it comes to actually constructing and managing a project like that. So we don't want to get involved on the construction side. Owning and operating, similar argument as well. We have the plenty of industrials that have an ambition to continue to be involved in operating nuclear plant, and there's some that looking to expand that aspect of their business. But also what's interesting, Jim, is those that are looking at these are energy developers looking at the small and modular sort of nuclear tech sector going, maybe we want to think about doing that ourselves. So there's a very interesting dynamic at this point of change at time, where you've got all these changes in play commercially. So, we're not looking to own and operate the plant. Yeah. The key element of our business model is speed. So you want to rely on the scale of others in your sector. And you also want to, from your own perspective, your own shareholder perspective, you want to be looking at the sort of lightest CapEx business model you can. And owning stuff, owning plant is quite capital demanding. Let others do that.
Well, you talked about this a little bit with the EPCs, and that is the relationships you have to build with the supply chain and other supporting elements of the industry. You guys at Terrestrial seem to have really assembled a list of rock stars when it comes to your industry partners and wow. supply chain providers. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, one of the benefits, Jim, of being, having been sort of operating your design process and your development process for, in our case, about 12, 13 years, is that you've had 12, 13 years to develop your supply chain. So this is not just about developing the design. It's also about developing, how you're going to construct it, where, developing so from a supply chain perspective, we have relationships with the well-known names on the component supply side, BWXT for steam generators, heat exchangers, reactor vessels. We've got a relationship with KSB Pumps on nuclear pumps. We need nuclear pumps. They make nuclear pumps. Our supply chain extends also to graphite. This is a graphite moderated system. I would say it includes the many relationships we have in North America, particularly amongst US national labs, to undertake all the R&D and testing work that you have to complete to secure the data you need under a QA program that now becomes acceptable and permissible in a license application. So that's part of your supply chain development as well. Who has the capabilities to undertake the tests you need to collect the data? And that's been going on in our case for over 10 years.
Well, we can't have a conversation about advanced reactors without talking about the regulatory side. You've brought this up already. You're through the vendor design review, phase one and two up in Canada, which is a really large and major and important accomplishment. How about here in the States? So where are you with the NRC?
Yeah. I just make one comment on the Canadian process. I mean, the Canadian process was so important because it was a driving function so that we could have a regulatory informed design process. You design for regulatory standards, it's probably self-evident, but until you actually engage with a regulator and fully understand the requirements, you probably can't say, you've got a truly regulatory informed design process. But that process has been, started engaging with the NRC actually almost at the same time as the Canadian regulator 2017. We're in the pre-application, process with the NRC. I'm sure you, Jim, are aware that consists of white papers, topical reports, and so forth. We have since we finished with the Canadian regulator in early 2023. We have swung our entire engineering effort to accelerate our engagement with the NRC. The NRC, though, has been involved, and this is by agreement, both sides of the table here. They've been involved in the vendor design review process in Canada, and we also were very willing to participate in a joint interagency review of an advanced reactor technology undertaken by the CNSC and the NRC, and that started in 2018. And those two agencies undertook their review of the advanced reactor technology. And the one they wanted to focus on was ours, the integral molten salt reactor. And I think that's testament to what we had established, and that was a sophisticated regulatory capability both sides of the border. So when the two agencies wanted to work on, a joint study, they knew that the reactor developer had the capabilities both sides of the border to support them on a successful study. So we're in the pre-application process and super focused on that and looking to accelerate that now.
So you'd mentioned also that the U.S., Canada, the U.K. were your three kind of primary locales that you're looking at. But where do you think your first reactor is going to deploy? Have you settled on that yet?
Well, it's definitely going to be the United States. We have a portfolio of projects. One that we can talk about quite publicly is the project to construct a integral molten salt reactor plant at the RELIS campus, which is a campus owned by Texas A&M. And that's certainly a leading project of ours at this point in time.
Well, to our listeners, we've had Reed Clay from the Texas Nuclear Alliance on in a previous episode. Please listen to that, because he talks about the great things happening at RELIS and the great initiatives.
There's a lot happening in Texas, a lot happening in RELIS. It's a very exciting relationship for us, actually, given all that's happening in Texas.
Yeah, it's 3 years. It's terrific to see the initiatives down there and the money they're putting on the table for developers to apply for. But you also had a recent announcement about a partnership with Ameresco. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. I mean, Ameresco is a project developer, and they've been in the business of developing energy projects. They have a long history of contracting with the federal government as well. So that's an important capability that they have. But we're partnering with Ameresco on IMSR plant projects. What's notable here is that this goes back to the deployment mode I mentioned earlier, Jim, where you're looking to near-locate, co-locate. This is about distributed generation, and this is about customizing the back end of your plant. Ameresco have got a lot of capabilities on integrating and customizing energy systems to meet particular customer requirements and market requirements. So, this relationship, we've got the front end of that power plant, the regulated piece that we've taken through regulators. We also have the back end as well in a standardized design. But so we've got the nuclear systems, the nuclear power plant. They've got the project development capabilities. I think in a strong business partnership, you have two people who bring very different capabilities to the table, and they bring a very different set of capabilities to the table than we have.
It sounds like a very impactful partnership. So what should we be looking for next from Terrestrial Energy?
Yes. So, we're going public and communication becomes ever more important. So you'll hear from us developments with our power plant project, probably in three buckets. Engineering and regulatory developments, they're important. I think a little bit difficult to communicate, Jim, those developments to a general audience, but nonetheless, we'll be talking about them. The supply chain developments, this is not just about, a design. This is about delivering the commissioned plant. And it's not just about delivering the commissioned plant. This is not a race to first plant. The real commercial race here, Jim, is to race the fleet deployment next decade. And that's the one where we want to win. So supply chain developments are going to be so important to demonstrate you have the capabilities in your supply chain to scale, deliver the fleet next decade. And the third bucket of developments is going to be on the project front. We're not looking to build and operate, okay? What we're looking to do is to supply the design, key components, fuel to a project. So we're making announcements such as the RELIS Texas A&M announcement on projects where we're looking to construct first plants and how we'll be making as those projects develop, we'll be making further press releases to communicate developments at the project level too.
Well, with your expertise and your experience, especially on the financial side, what's your overall view of the state of the U.S. advanced nuclear industry, especially where are we compared to where we were a few years ago?
I think it's an extraordinary moment of change. I'll just share a comment that I made in our shareholder letter at the end of the year, and it's meant to be deliberately a very provocative comment because moments of change are not obvious when you're in the middle of them. And the comment I made to shareholders was that 2025 may possibly be what 1995 was to tech when the internet came to be. This is a pivot moment. Nuclear and nuclear tech is capable of delivering massive things. When one says as an executive of a nuclear tech company today, that you're pursuing a $1 trillion opportunity, that is not an exaggeration. Energy and the energy sector is the largest and is the prime mover of the entire economy. If you have the ability to transform something in the energy sector, you have the opportunity of doing something that's very, very substantial. So it's a super exciting time. And I think, my observations over the last 12 months are that if you looked at that collective mind of public market investors, their collective actions, they're expressing the same thing. What's going on now, Jim, is only just the start, as 1995 was for the tech revolution, which is obviously, you know, had a 25-year head start on us in the nuclear tech sector. But certainly this is a very, very exciting moment.
I'm not sure we can top that, but do you have any other closing thoughts you'd like to add for our audience?
It's a good closing thought. But I'll just to share another one with you as well. I mean, you hear all these statements of we have to triple nuclear and that President Trump has gone one best. We have to quadruple nuclear. But let's say let's triple nuclear. In the United States, that means that we have to, by mid-century, we have to be, that would mean that we'd have to be announcing, let's say, you know, before you can start construction, you start construction January 2030. Let's have a nice simple model. January 2030, to triple nuclear, you're going to have to announce either the construction of one new AP1000 every single month for the next 20 years, okay, or you're going to be announcing the construction of four new small modular reactors every month for 20 years. That's what tripling means. That's putting the numbers to the statements to be made on the policy side, which says this is what the country needs. And those policy statements are being increasingly adopted and expressed by those on the demand side, particularly in big industry and big tech in particular. That is a massive bill program. And we're heading straight down the road towards it. So this is a moment of tremendous change. And I think... just given where we've come from, this really is just the start of something that's going to be much bigger.
Well, thank you for that, Simon. It's really been a pleasure speaking with you. I know our audience are going to benefit from these insights. You've really captured things in a really holistic and strategic way that's very helpful. So thanks so much to you for the overview on terrestrial energy. Best of luck to you and the terrestrial energy team for continued success in the months and years ahead.
Well, Jim, thank you very much and enjoyed our conversation this morning. Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Well, thank you, Simon. Again, please check out Terrestrial Energy at terrestrialenergy.com. It's a great company. And that does it for this episode of the Advanced Nuclear Podcast. We at UCAN, we believe that the advanced nuclear technologies are the key to powering the American economy in the years ahead. If you want to learn more about us, you can find us at ucanpower.org. A special thanks to the team at UCAN and our producer, Ms. Kimberly, for her hard work. She's a true professional, and someday her face will be carved into the Mount Rushmore of podcasting. Until next time, this is your host signing off, and thanks to you for tuning in to the Advanced Nuclear Podcast.